a good kvittel to all of you, a piskatava. We're at the point now where Yom Kippur is past, but Shmini Atzeres and Hoshana Rabbah still loom. And under those conditions, we're at a point where, although Ne'ilah closed the gates, there's still a little crack. And all of us should still be on our best behavior. We actually should be on our best behavior all year, but certainly at this time and during these critical times for our people and for ourselves. This shiur is going to be a bit different. If you take a look at the source sheet, if you have them, and as you follow with me, you'll see that, in that I did not actually put too many sources on the source sheet, because what we're going to have today is something of a smorgasbord. We're going to talk about the holiday of Sukkot in a global fashion and try to understand some of the themes that emerge from it, the way those themes emerge from it. And we're going to see that these themes actually do coalesce and create a solid, unified picture of this holiday that really is very serious and very important. If we had more shiurim and more time in between these events, we would, you know, in between the holidays, I would of course spend more time on each of these themes as we encounter them. But what we're going to do is we're going to try to do them in a global sense and understand, as I said, the unified picture that emerges from these themes. Let's begin. If you look at the source sheet before you, let's begin with some of the basic foundations that make Sukkot so unique and so important on the calendar. Dual personality of Sukkot Shmini Atzeres festivals. The dual personality of Sukkot and Shmini Atzeres festivals, that they are the culmination of both the Shalosh Regalim and the Yamim Noraim. So let's first understand that Sukkot is a culminating festival. Let's begin with its place in the Shalosh Regalim. The Shalosh Regalim, in addition to be historically based, are also, of course, agriculturally based, the three pilgrim festivals. There are different parts to the harvest. You have the holiday of Pesach, festival of Pesach, the barley harvest. You have Shavuot, the Zman HaBikurim, etc., the first fruits and wheat harvest beginning. And then you have Sukkot, which is the harvest festival, which is the culmination of all of the Shalosh Regalim. And if the Shalosh Regalim are supposed to be a time of Simcha, then you have the Shalosh, you have Sukkot as Zman Simchasenu, Zman, our time of joy in its fullness. Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the celebration that used to take place in the temple of the water drawing. This is the ultimate time of Simcha, with Shmini Atzeres being even more so, and therefore the culmination of the Shalosh Regalim. At the same time, although Sukkot is firmly rooted in the Shalosh Regalim cycle, it is, as we know, because of its placement on the calendar, also the culmination of the Yamim Noraim. As I began, I said the door is still open a crack. And you have continued through Sukkot and through Shmini Atzeres themes of the Yamim Noraim, which continue to resound throughout this Yom Tov. Speaking of Kohelet, which is very serious, you have the door open a crack until of Tshuva, open a crack until Shana Hoshana Rabbah, Shmini Atzeres. You have the concept of the Pit Katava, or in Yiddish, the good kvittel. And therefore, coursing through Shmini Atzeres and Sukkot, and its joy and its tremendous celebration, is also the seriousness of the Yamim Noraim. And how we correlate those and how we balance those comes out in the second basic foundation, which is the true definition of Simcha. The true definition of Simcha, Zman Simchatenu, is that we are not talking, there's a difference between happiness and fun, many have said. There's a difference between what we often confuse with happiness. Happiness is something that comes not through escape, not through Disneyland. Happiness is something that comes through the discovery of true meaning in life. through the discovery of true balance in life. And therefore, Zman Simchatenu, the time of celebration, is not a time to escape, but it's a time to confront reality. And we will confront reality, as I'll continue to show you throughout this holiday. And therefore, the seriousness of the Yamim Noraim remains part of this celebration in a very real way, because it helps us maintain our balance. And finally, the last of the basic foundations, I think in some ways it's the most important, because it defines how we accomplish everything we're supposed to accomplish on Sukkot. And that is that Sukkot, placed as it is at the end of the Yamim Noraim experience, is a balance to the Yamim Noraim. The Yamim Noraim, on some level, are really an attempt to escape, are really an attempt to leave behind the reality of our existence through the essential understanding of control, or an attempt to control. What do we do on the Yamim Noraim? We turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we say we live in an uncertain time and we want to control that uncertainty. We want, please God, for you to write us in the Book of Chaim. We want us to write us with the Tzaddikim. We want you to control the uncertainty of our lives. We want to get away from this disease. We want to get away from this Magefa. We want to live in a certain world. Once the Yamim Noraim and we enter Sukkot, what we find is an embrace of uncertainty. We're no longer trying to control that uncertainty, but we're rather accepting its reality, we're accepting its existence, and we're embracing the uncertainty of life. We turn to HaKadosh Baruch when we say to him, we've made every effort to control our lives. We've made every effort to pray to you that our lives be filled with good things and with positive things. We've made every effort to do tshuva and to merit that certainty and to merit that goodness. But now that we come to the holiday of Sukkot, in a sense, we're letting go. In a sense, what we're doing is we're allowing ourselves to say, in spite of everything we've done, in spite of everything we've tried, this is not a certain world. It's not a world where tomorrow is predictable. Very interestingly, I read the last line of an article recently written on a, I forget the name of the artist, concerning a Jewish artist who's gained fame. He says his favorite Yiddish expression is, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. And that's what our world is teaching us. That's what this world is teaching us today. That so much remains in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's control and is beyond our control, as much as we try to control it. So at the beginning of the year, we have this balance which will course through our lives this year. And that's why I say Chag HaSukkot, especially this year, especially in the world in which we find ourselves. Because we're turning to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we're saying, we're going to try to control things. We're going to wear our masks. We're going to do what we need to do. We're going to do everything we can. But at some level, this is an uncertain world. And only you, Kadosh Baruch Hu, can give us what we need. And therefore, we're embracing that uncertainty and we're allowing it to really enter our lives. That embrace of uncertainty, psychologists will tell you today, is really an important aspect of mental health. I happen to have sometimes anxiety. I'm learning that anxiety can be good. It if taken too far, it can be destructive. But recognizing that we live in an uncertain world and embracing the reality of that uncertainty is embracing reality itself. And therefore, the baz of balance to the Yamim Noraim, Sukkot, serves as that embrace. Now, how it does that, the ways in which it does that, is through its mitzvot. And we're going to take a look at the two sets of mitzvot of Sukkot, but we're going to give particular weight to the sukkah, where the two sets, of course, are the sukkah and the arba minim. We'll talk about the arba minim at the end of the shir, but we're focusing particularly on the sukkah, and on a series of messages that emerge from the sukkah in a very unusual way. Let's start with, as you see, we're up to Roman numeral 2, Asei sukkatcha keva vidiratcha arai. So the statement halachically concerning the sukkah is that we're supposed to make our sukkah keva, we're supposed to make that sukkah, we're supposed to make it the permanent, vidiratcha arai, and to make the homes in which we live, the things that we think are permanent, we're supposed to make them temporary, impermanent. Now this mandate is actually a play on words. Why is it a play on words? Because the definition of a sukkah, as we will see, is that a sukkah must be a dirat arai, that a sukkah has to be an impermanent structure. How we achieve that, we'll talk about in just a few moments. But as a dirat arai, what we're doing is we're saying we're supposed to be making our dirat arai keva. What we're supposed to be doing in our minds, what we're supposed to be doing in our world, is we're supposed to take that which we think is permanent, that which we define as permanent, and recognize that it's not permanent at all. And we're supposed to take the dirat arai, we're supposed to take the impermanent structure of the sukkah and make that permanent in our minds. Recognize that that represents permanence. So on a very first level, on a very basic level, what are we saying? We're saying that we are embracing, as I said, uncertainty. We're taking this dirat arai, which is defined as temporary, and we're making it keva. In doing so, what are we saying? We are saying that we accept frailty and temporariness. We will see that the definition of a dirat arai in our world, in a halachic world of sukkah, is defined by the schach. It's defined by the ceiling. And what must be the fundamental criteria of the ceiling? It must be open to the heavens. It must be open. It has to consist, we'll see, of certain material, and there'll be a message in that as well. But it has to be open to the heavens, recognizing that no matter how hard we build those walls, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in control of our lives. We are therefore accepting, as I said, and this is psychologically sound, we are accepting the reality of uncertainty. Unless we're willing to accept that, if we fight against the uncertainty and say, I don't want that uncertainty, we will never be psychologically healthy, because the reality of our lives is that they are uncertain. And finally, we are also going to accept not only the reality of uncertainty, but we're going to accept its benefits as well. And here I want to take you away for a moment to another area of Jewish law. Take away for a moment from the world of sukkah to the world of daily life. If we take the day, and I may have mentioned this to you before in other contexts, if we take our Jewish day, our Jewish day begins at night, of course, begins with the evening, and ends when the next evening arrives. The problem is, however, that when it comes to the beginning of each day, when it comes to that definition of night, there is uncertainty. We're not sure when the next day actually begins. We don't, and the reason we're not sure when the day begins is we're not sure what is considered night. There are two basic signposts within the day's development, which conceivably can be the beginning of night. They are, on the one hand, shkia, sunset, and on the other hand, they are not only shkia, but they are also seis hakochavim, what we would refer to as nightfall. If you see me pause periodically, it's to let people in from the waiting room who are coming a little late. Anyhow, the difference, again, shkia is sunset, nightfall is seis hakochavim, or when the stars come out, which itself is a matter of dispute. But leave that aside. Let's assume that we accept seis hakochavim as three minimal stars, which is what we usually do for Shabbos. The period between shkia and seis hakochavim is a period of uncertainty in halacha. It's a period where we are not sure where it belongs. Does it belong to the day before, which would mean that nightfall occurs at stars out, and that period between sunset and stars out belongs to the previous day? Or does it belong to the day that's coming, the following day? And that the day really begins, nightfall, or what we consider night, begins with sunset, and therefore the period of Ben Hashmashos between sunset and nightfall is a period, it really belongs to the next day. Now, this period of uncertainty is something that we could go on through our lives without really thinking about, because halacha really accounts for it. Shabbos begins early and ends late. Why is that so? Because we begin Shabbos at sunset and we end at nightfall. Now, complicating things again is that the definition of sunset, the definition of nightfall are also in dispute, but we'll leave that out. That period of Bein HaShemashos becomes Shabbos. Why? Because Shabbos is a D'oraisa mitzvah. Shabbos is a biblical mitzvah. And when you're not sure, when you have a suffix concerning a biblical mitzvah, you have to be stringent. And therefore, you add on to Shabbos Bein HaShemashos and a little more, and you add on to Shabbos Bein HaShemashos at its end, and that's why it begins at sunset, basically, or a little before, and ends a little after nightfall. Once in a while, you'll encounter this period, however, as a halachic issue. The counting of Sefirat HaOmer, I think I mentioned to you, is can you count during that period? When does that period belong to? A child, like my oldest child, Avi, who's over 40 years old now, Kenai Nahara, but was born Bein HaShemashos Friday night, had to have his bris on Sunday, even though that certainly was not the eighth day. Why? Because you can't have the bris on Friday because it may be a day too early. Bein HaShemashos may really be part of the next day. You can't have it a day later because you can only have Shabbos, a bris on Shabbos, if you know for sure the baby's born on Shabbos, and therefore you don't know for sure he was born on Shabbos. Maybe he was born on Friday. And therefore, you have to have the bris on Sunday. Now, putting aside the halachic issues, isn't it strange that we who are so consistent with our mandating time, we who say that Lichtbenchen is 6:52 in 10 seconds or whatever we do, the Kriya Shema, the end of Kriya Shema is 9:53 or whatever it may be, why do we accept a period of uncertainty? Why do we allow that to exist? Why don't Chazal just simply say, so it could be that we just can't. But it also is, I believe, because in the context of each day, we want there to be a period of uncertainty. Not only because we need to accept that uncertainty exists, but we also have to recognize its benefit. We also have to recognize that uncertainty is very often what powers our contribution, is very often what powers our accomplishments. If everything were certain, if we knew that we would be X, Y, Z, if we knew that we would accomplish this and we would accomplish that or we would get there, then we probably wouldn't have the aspiration. We wouldn't work hard. It is uncertainty in life. The fact that we don't know what tomorrow will bring, that very often powers our accomplishments. And therefore, Bein HaShemashos as its existence, and now the holiday of Sukkot, which I tell you is the holiday that embraces uncertainty, that is the day, that is the message that it's not only an acceptance of, but a recognition of the necessity of uncertainty in our lives. Now let's go on. If, as we've said, that the basic definition of the sukkah is that it is a dirat arai, it's a temporary dwelling, then the truth is that the rules that govern its building and its construction are really very, very strange. If I were to back up, and let's take a look, let's imagine that we were not told how we should build the sukkah. And the only real rule was, if you have to build a temporary structure, you would have rules concerning the building of the entire structure. And those rules would be governed by temporariness. In other words, you'd have to have temporary, you'd have to have certain material for the walls, you'd have to have certain material for how strongly it stands, you'd have to have certain material for the ceiling. And we do, we have basic rules concerning all of it, but when it comes to the walls of the sukkah, and I brought down here the Shulchan Aruch's Psak, which of course is based upon the Gemara, which is based upon the received law, kol hadvarim ksherim lidefanos. Every single material is kosher for the walls. Now, caveat. It has to be material that stands beruach mitzuyah. It has to be material that will stand in a normal wind. But it can be, doesn't have to be canvas. It doesn't have to be frail. It can be brick. It can be wood. As you know, if I am lucky enough to have a house where I have a room, which is a regular room with regular walls, but has a retractable ceiling, and it retracts completely, and I can put schach on that ceiling for sukkahs, then that room in my house becomes a sukkah. Now, why should that be? If this is meant to be a dirat arai, if this is meant to be a temporary structure, then why doesn't the halacha require that aspect of temporariness, of impermanence, not only in the schach, but in the walls as well? Why are the walls allowed to be of any material, even the most permanent? And here, again, we're assuming, we're gonna make leaps of interpretation here, building on the halachot. And I would like to suggest that here, the representation of the sukkah is the representation of the Jewish journey. It's the representation of our journey across time as a nation, not just our personal journeys, we'll talk about that, but it also represents the journey of Klal Yisrael across time. Imagine, you go into the sukkah, and this is why sukkah is one of my favorite mitzvot. Because you enter the sukkah, you're leaving everything behind, and what you're trying to enter is what is permanent. And what is permanent on a historical level is the Jewish journey, is the journey of our people across time. And the Jewish journey speaks of permanence and impermanence. And that is that in each generation, we think we are establishing the real Jewish community, the permanence of our community. And yet, our communities are not permanent. Our homes are not permanent. Our shuls are not permanent. If any year we see that now. And therefore, there is a unity to our Jewish journey. And that is the walls may differ, but the ceiling is the same. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is there are Jewish communities that live in brick and mortar. The United States community, the American Jewish community, the British Jewish, certain communities that for years lived in brick and mortar and felt, oh, this is safe, this is where we belong, we're okay here. And they've seen themselves as different from the Jewish communities in Africa or in Arab lands where the walls are certainly not made of brick and mortar, where the walls are made of other substances that seem to be very frail and seem to be very vulnerable, and the communities seem vulnerable. Well, guess what? Guess what? The communities that live in brick and mortar are quickly learning that they are really, in a fundamental way, no different from the communities that are living in with walls that are much frailer, much weaker. How many times have we said, as we've looked at the political changes sweeping across America, as we've looked at the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe and in America as well, the bricks and mortar are beginning to crumble. God forbid. God forbid. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they'll still stand. But the bricks and mortar don't look as permanent as they did yesterday. And perhaps that's what the sukkah is teaching us. You can make your walls of anything you want. You can make your walls as solid as that brick. Just remember, you're really no different. And you are living in a community, as long as you're not living in your own land, and your own land has its own has its own challenges, and we'll talk about those. But as long as you're living in the land where others are in charge, as long as you're living in Golos, brick and mortar, the canvas, the whatever else you're using, it's all the same. It's all open to the heavens. And don't think that you are as secure as you'd like to think in that particular Golos community, because you're not. And that is the unity of the Jewish journey across time. The walls, make them of anything you want, but recognize their impermanence. And this brings historical perspective concerning our own challenges this year as well. You know, one of the things that the corona, and you know, in Israel, they don't know what I call it COVID, and they don't know what I'm talking about. One of the things that corona has taught us is how similar we are to eras past. You know, until this year, when we spoke about pandemics, or we spoke about polio, or we spoke about smallpox, or we spoke about the Spanish flu, and we spoke about them as historical events in our minds. We basically said, you know what? I think most of us anyway, that's part of the past. We're living in a scientific era. We're living in an era where we can conquer those things. We're living in an era of vaccinations. We're living in an era of science. We're living in an era of prevention. Along comes HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and for whatever reason he feels he wants to or needs to, he says, I'm going to teach you a lesson. You haven't come that far. I'm still in charge. And the natural world that I've created is still in charge and is still going to present you with challenges. And don't think you are really that different from the 1800s that had to deal with their pandemics or their plagues. You have not yet arrived at a point, and will not arrive at a point, where you can make your worlds completely certain biologically. And this has really been a sobering year for us all, not only on a personal level, but on a national and communal level, to make us realize that although we've come so far in so many ways, in other ways we have not come as far as we thought. And certainly that will carry over into in the area of the way we behave and the things we do, but certainly even in the area of our science and our technology, this provides a historical perspective for us. Okay, so the walls can be anything you want, because the rules are teaching us that those walls will still be temporary, no matter how strong you feel they are. Now let's go to the next. And here, when in one of my volumes, I speak about this. This actually was a wake-up call for me, and it destroyed one of my childhood beliefs and one of my childhood fantasies. It had to do also with my bar mitzvah pasha, which is Emor. The halacha that emerges from the mandate that emerges from the Torah concerning the creation of sukkah is summed up in the psukim that I have for you here on the sources. Basukot Yeshu Shivat Yamim, Kolo Ezrach Yisrael Yeshu Basukot. You shall dwell in Sukkot for 7 days. Every citizen of Israel shall dwell in Sukkot. Leman Yedu Dorosechem. This is very interesting. Here, the word is not, the Torah doesn't use the word that it usually uses for a mitzvah that's historical. It doesn't say Leman Zichru, that you should remember. Leman Yedu, so that you will know, Kivasukot, Oshavti, Epenei Israel, etc., 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 because I caused you to dwell in Sukkot. And one of the reasons, and the rabbis say, the Tur, for example, and others, seem to indicate that there's a special yidi'ah that has to take place with the mitzvah of Sukkah. Not just zichru, but you have to understand the mitzvah, you have to know what it is, you have to know what it represents, And I wonder if that isn't why, because we, as I've said so far, we're all always dwelling in Sukkot, and that yediyah, that recognition that we are living in uncertain lives, our uncertain lives, is something that should be carried over from the holiday of Sukkot to a yediyah all year round. But anyway, the question is, okay, so I need to know what the Sukkot represent. What do they represent? What is it that they're representing? And apparently, there is a dispute in the Gemara. When I was a child, it was simple. What does my sukkah represent? As I built it with my father, Alav HaShalom, it represents the Sukkot. It represents those booths that Klal Yisrael built as they traveled through the desert, first for a short period, then when the Cheder Maraglim takes place, longer period. But it appears that that's not so simple. There's a dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer in the Gemara. What do the Sukkot represent? Rabbi Akiva says, Sukkot mamash. Rabbi Akiva says that they represent, as I thought as a child, and as many of us still think, perhaps, the Sukkot represent the Sukkot mamash. They represent the actual physical structures built by Klal Yisrael, and where re-entering the Sukkah, we're entering, as I told you, that the Jewish journey. We're remaking those Sukkot that were made at the beginning of our national journey, and we're entering into the national journey as we enter the Sukkah. Rabbi Eliezer says no. Eliezer says that is not what the Sukkot represent. What the Sukkot represent are the Anane HaKavod. What the Sukkot represent are the clouds of glory that HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided, that surrounded Klal Yisrael and protected them during their desert journey. Oh, so now the Sukkot don't represent the actual booths, according to Rabbi Eliezer, they represent those Anane HaKavod. So one could argue, and you see that I do argue it in number three very, very briefly, Elu V'Elu. As is always the case when it comes to biblical interpretation, as is always the case when it comes to halacha, both of these are acceptable. Each position is correct, Sukkot mamash of Rabbi Akiva, and the Anane HaKavod, and what it's telling us is that there's a partnership in our journey. God will protect us through the Anane HaKavod, will protect us as a people, will ensure that we are not, God forbid, destroyed, but at the same time, we have to build our Sukkot mamash, a very nice argument, and perhaps we accept both positions. However, halacha does something strange. It accepts one version, which is not strange in and of itself, because although elu va'elu, we have to know what we halachically feel, we have to know what it is that we are actually agreeing to, what we actually feel, and therefore there is a verdict. And after much discussion among the poskim, the verdict that emerges, I don't know that happened, but I'm making it a little bigger. The verdict that emerges is that Rabbi Eliezer is correct. Take a look at the Shulchan Aruch. Basukot teshvu shivat yamin, ki basukot hoshavti es b'nei Yisrael. You should live in Sukkot, the Shulchan Aruch says, the Machaber says. Heim anane hakavod, sheikifam bohem. These are the Anane HaKavod that God surrounded us with, and that's what the Sukkot represent. And when you go into the Sukkah, you're supposed to think not of the Sukkot mamash alone, you can think about that too, but primarily, you're supposed to think about the Exodus from Egypt, and you're supposed to think of the Anane HaKavod that surrounded us, the clouds of glory that surrounded us, that's what the Sukkot represent. And this is fascinating when you think about it. Really very interesting. Why are we accepting the Anane HaKavod as the one that the majority of halachists will accept? Wouldn't it have been simpler to accept Rabbi Akiva's Sukkot Mamash? So one reason may be because of the Pasuk itself. The Pasuk says, Laman Yehidu Dorasechem Kiva Sukkot Ho Shavti. I caused them to dwell. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is creating the Sukkot in which they dwell, so it's the Anane HaKavod. I could argue against it. I could say, nonetheless, it's the booths. About a couple of years ago, another answer came to me as to why we are so intent on seeing, why we're so intent on seeing these, hold on, please. so intent on seeing these particular booths that we create, not as booths, but as representation of the Ananya Kavod. And in order to understand this, I want to go back for a moment to something I wrote here. The sukkah is the prism for our re-entry into the world. And that's what we've seen so far. What we've seen so far is that as we're emerging from the Yamim Noraim, and as we're emerging, and again to review that attempt to control uncertainty and that attempt to live a life that where everything is predictable and good, we enter into the sukkah, and that's the prism through which we re-enter reality. That prism has to focus on one thing that we often leave out, and that is God. You know, it's fascinating, and I quote this in one of my books, and I just want to read you a couple of pieces that, just a couple of facts. In 2011, Moment Magazine had an interview with 14 Jewish thinkers. And the 14 Jewish thinkers were posed with this question: only a third to half of American Jews today believe in an almighty deity. Can there be Judaism without a belief in God? Can there be Judaism without a belief in God? And the answers to this question were split. And once this question was raised, then a number of other places picked up the question. The Washington Post had an article entitled, "Judaism Without God? Yes, Say American Atheists." And quotes were featured that seemed to indicate that Judaism can allow for this. Atheism and Judaism, I'm quoting, are not contradictory. So to have an atheist in a Jewish congregation, it isn't a challenge. It's par for the course. It is our tradition to question God from top to bottom. Also cited in the Washington Post article was a study conducted by Robert Putnam and David Campbell, author of the book American Grace. Fully one half of American Jews doubt God's existence. Provocative observation was presented by investigative journalist and committed Jew Stephen Fried in a popular book, The New Rabbi, where he wrote, quote, "In Judaism, belief in God is optional. Something you may wrestle with your entire life, but respect for and fascination with the Torah, the first record of men and women's struggle with God, belief in God, is not optional." Now, this is a fascinating issue when you think about it. If you went to Catholics and asked, can there be Catholicism without belief in God? I think the question would be seen as extremely strange. If you went to Islam, committed Muslims and said to them, can there be Islam without belief in God? I think you'd have to run the other way. And yet when it comes to Judaism, there is this issue. Can you believe? And in fact, there is even a quote in rabbinic literature where Hashem says, "Luosi shachachu v'sorasi shamaru." I wish they would forget wondering about me and just observe what I want them to be, just observe the Torah. And why is this? Why is it that the religion that gave rise to monotheism, the religion that gave rise to Judaism, Christianity, Islam, that introduced this concept of one God, why are we so uncertain in many ways when it comes to the majority of Jews concerning God? And you have a variety of answers. One answer may be, of course, that Jewishness is defined as in terms of biology, and therefore you're asking a lot of people who themselves haven't bought into the process, you're asking them because they are Jews by definition. Another reason may be that we have this tradition of questioning. We have this tradition of asking and questioning everything, and even questioning at times HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The famous story of one of the great Hasidic rabbis who on Rosh Hashanah refused to blow the shofar and then finally did. And when he first refused to blow the shofar, he says, "You've given us a horrible year and we're not ready to blow the shofar." And yet then he sounds the shofar. This struggle with belief, and then finally the truth is that because of this struggle, I think that in our education, of our young, not so much here in Israel, but certainly in the American modern Orthodox community, and I wonder if it's true in other quote modern Orthodox communities, we rarely talk about God. We talk about the mitzvot, but we don't talk to our children about belief because we have our own issues. And I think perhaps what Rabbi Eliezer is saying is that the prism through which you re-enter the world has to be a prism which is God-centered. Has to be a prism that doesn't speak to you about what you do to control uncertainty and what you do to build your booths, but has to be a prism that represents the anane kavod created by a Kodesh Baruch. And what this means, of course, is that God has to be in the picture for all of us and for all of our children. We can't dismiss a Kodesh Baruch Hu and say, just focus on his Torah. Can't do that. We have to say the Torah and God. We have to speak about God. Now, for some of us, that journey may take us, and I've always been jealous of my friends who have that, who it takes the issue to a place of permanence, and that is pure belief. No questions, no wrestling, emuna tmima, a certain emuna. I think my sisters have this, where there's never a question, and there's never a doubt, and there's never an issue. And you believe that God is controlling everything, and that may, it may take you to that end of the journey. It may take you to the end that's somewhat, I think, sometimes closer to me, where I'm constantly wrestling with the belief in an almighty God and sometimes the evil and the issues that I see in the world and this wrestle, this, but I accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu and then wrestle with those doubts. And the wrestling with those doubts is my own belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and my own bringing God into the world in a way that I need to bring God into the world. But God has to be there. The discussion has to be there. Too many of our children grow up without any discussion from their parents nor from their teachers about belief in the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And perhaps that's why these statistics emerge, and perhaps that's why also when it comes to our entry into the world, the prism through which we re-enter the world has to be not the booths we create, but Rebbe Eliezer's Anane HaKavod. Because our world has to be a world in which God is present, and our struggle with him and our struggle with his issue, the issues that his existence raises, and our ability to believe, all of this has to be part of our lives, whether it's the belief in Emuna Tmima or anywhere on the spectrum, it has to be part of our lives. And perhaps that's why we accept Rabbi Eliezer over Rabbi Akiva, and the prism through which we enter the world, the sukkah has to represent the anane hakavod and not the actual booths. We keep going. There is another surprising aspect to the sukkah, which I think teaches us a very, very significant lesson as we re-enter our world, the prism through which we re-enter our world. And that is that the sukkah doesn't have to be perfect. It's very interesting when you think about it. What's the rule? If you were to create, again, the rules to create a sukkah, you would say it needs four walls. It needs actual four walls. It has to be a perfect sukkah. It has to be a perfect booth. The Anane HaKavod surrounded us. And yet when it comes to the sukkah, there are very strict rules concerning the sukkah, but we're lenient when it comes to the walls. A kosher sukkah can have three walls. Kosher sukkah can have even two and some, two and a half. And again, I'm not Haskening for you now. I'm just telling you that the sukkah does not have to have those four complete walls, and you should ask your rav how much you need. But on a theological level, why not insist on perfection? Why not say, you know what, the sukkah, you got to build the sukkah, it's got to be perfect. Why not, we can compare it to other mitzvot, and we don't have to look too far. When it comes to the esrog, if you want to have an esrog mehudar, an etrog mehudar, you're looking, you're trying to make sure it doesn't have imperfections, it's the right, why not be as strict when it comes to the sukkah? And the answer to that perhaps is that we're entering a year which won't be perfect. Where there will be imperfection and we're not always going to succeed and there will be failure. You know, if you take a look at the final messages that are given to, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe, and this is also appropriate to speak about now because they are unfolding in the Torah as we speak. I just chose one, but there's a refrain that keeps repeating. Hashem appears in Ohel Moed, Vayomer Hashem O Moshe, Hincha Shov Chev Im Avosecha. Behold, you're going to die. Vikom ha'om hazeh v'zona acharei Elokei nechor ha'aretz. And I'm telling you, don't think things are going to be rosy. After you die, your nation is going to rebel. And then they will begin to worship strange gods. And v'chora api b'yom ha'hu v'azavtim v'starti panai mehem. I will hide my face from them. This hester panim, there will be a time of vanochi haster astir panai b'yom hazeh, I'm going to hide my face from them. This is this frightening prediction of God's hiddenness, which so many of us understand to be the essence. The Rav Soloveitchik talks about the Holocaust as a time of hester panim, where God retreats and allows the tohu vavohu of the world, the basic chaos of the world, to reemerge. You have to ask yourself, does Hashem have to say this to Moshe? Like, isn't this a little bit too much information? Why not allow Moshe to pass? It's rough enough that poor Moshe isn't able to enter the land and can't see the culmination of his journey and the journey of his people. But now, before his death, he has to hear about all these difficulties over and over and over again. Why can't HaKadosh Baruch Hu just simply say, don't worry, Moshe, it'll be all right, which, by the way, is the next psukim that I didn't quote bring, which is after Hester Ponim, God will accept the people and bring them back. And perhaps, it's a very strange way of saying it, it's a harsh way of doing it, perhaps the message here is life isn't perfect, and failure is inevitable. And not only is failure inevitable, failure is important because it is through failure that we then rise again. That's the whole concept of the Yomim Noraim. And the concept is, by the way, that we're told that if you do tshuva me'ahava, then all the chataim you did are not only not discounted, but if you do really full tshuva, they'll be counted as mitzvot because your failures teach you and your failures change you. And there is a value to failure. I remember when I came here often with my shul during difficult times on missions. So one time we went and visited various places that where technology was emerging to show the technological piece of Israel and its growth. And one refrain that kept repeating itself in every single place that we went was, we're different than you, America. Failure is acceptable to us. When someone fails, we don't fire him. We promote him. Well, not always. But if that failure was real, he tried, and now he knows more. Now he's going to succeed because now he knows what didn't work, and you can go. And so too often, we forget this important message. Too often, when it comes to our children, we try to protect them from potential failure. And when we do that, the value of imperfection and failure, they're not equipped to face the world. This is a mistake that we make as parents and as a society. We reject failure. We try to say, well, I don't want my kid to fail. I don't want my child to stumble. I don't want my child to fail. And the answer is no, let them go. Let them go and let them succeed or fail on their own. The number of parents in my community in Englewood who would write the essays for their children to get into college instead of allowing them or challenging them to write their own essay. What do they think? They're going to get into college and then they're going to be able to write all the essays for them from then on? No, let your child succeed or fail, stand or fall. And in each case, that failure will allow you to succeed more. So it's an acceptance. The sukkah doesn't have to be perfect because our worlds won't be perfect and because the imperfection is important. It will allow us to succeed tomorrow. Again, that's the prism through which we're re-entering our world. And finally, the last, and we're running out of time, so I have to move a little faster, I see. The last of our lessons from the Sukkah, and there perhaps could be so many more, the nature of the Schach. What is the definition of the Schach that we elevate to the most important part of the Sukkah? The definition in the Talmud is it has to be mipsoles goren vayekev. Literally, it has to be from the rubbish, from the things that you throw away from the storehouse and from the winery. It has to be the branches, the things that you overlook, that you're not taking in when you're collecting the wheat and the grain. It has to be natural. It has to grow from the ground. It can't be something that is set aside for a purpose. It can't be makabel tuma. It has to be the material that you normally overlook. That material which you normally overlook in the storehouse, the granary, and in the winery and in the wine press, that is the material which you elevate and place on the top of the sukkah, and that defines that prism with which you're entering the world. And what is the lesson? Appreciate the overlooked. Sometimes the things that we don't think are important are the most important of all. I again quote a quote which is powerful, and someone told me that they requoted it to me. It's not mine. I don't know who said it. He said, I never ever met anybody who, God forbid, on their deathbed said, I wish I would have spent more time in the office. I wish I would have spent more time with my kids. This concept of quality time is a lie. Kids will remember things we don't think they will remember, and the things they think they will remember, they don't remember. The more time we spend with them, the more time we don't overlook the small moments, the catch in the yard, the various different pieces that we don't think are as important as those major trips, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we're gonna switch. Everything we've learned now is from the mitzvah of Sukkah. How is that balanced by the Arba meaning? And here, I thought I'd have more time. I'm gonna be very quick. Whereas Sukkah is a mitzvah that speaks to us of our shared journey, speaks to us of our lives, and we're all in this uncertain world. There's a fascinating halacha when it comes to the Arba meaning. It comes from the words, ulekachtem lachem. Kachtem lachem, when the Arba meaning, it says, you shall take for yourselves. What it says, what the halacha says is the following. The Arba Minim have to belong to you, at least on the first day of Yontif. I can't, on the first day of Yontif, and in the diaspora, the first two, I can't go to my friend and say, let me borrow your Arba Minim. I have to say to him, please give me your Arba Minim as a matana al menas lahachzir. Please give it to me now as a matana, so it belongs to me, on the condition I'll return it. I'll give it right back. But at the moment that I perform the mitzvah, it has to be my Arba Minim. And the rabbis ask, is that the case when it comes to the mitzvah of Sukkah? And they say, no, when it comes to the mitzvah of Sukkah, Roy, it would be appropriate for all of us to dwell in one Sukkah. So what's the balance that's being created by these two mitzvot, sets of mitzvot? In this holiday that we are, where we're talking about all of these things that we share and all of the struggle that we have as a people, there is another set of mitzvot that speak to us of the individual and the importance of the individual. And if you go to the imagery of the Arba Minim and the Medrash, so many things we learned as children that represents different kinds of Jews, those with taste, those with no, those with smell and taste. It represents different kinds of Jews. It represents different parts of the body. All of these representations are to remind us of our individuality. And even the story of the Arba Minim and the way we, and we're not going to have time to talk about this now, we'll return to it someday, how history is affected by one individual and the mitzvah changes under the tutelage in the time of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, because it changes, it's how, that we take it all 7 days instead of just the first days, even outside of the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because one individual can shape history. And we are reminded of that balance, particularly now in our time. In our time, as we return to our world, and this is a challenging world, and it's a world in which we are all facing together tremendous challenges, the importance of each individual playing his or her role simply by taking responsibility, simply by wearing a mask, simply by doing things not only to protect ourselves, but others, becomes so critically important. And therefore, Sukkah speaks to us of the balance between the individual and the community and the role the individual plays in ensuring the community's health and the community's success. Another message that emerges that is so important for us. And so in summary, and then I'll take, of course, any questions or comments. Sukkot is the balance to the Yamim Noraim. We tried to control our uncertain worlds. We're embracing our uncertain worlds. The Sukkah is the prism through which we re-enter the real world with all of its challenges. And it teaches us so many lessons, all of which we've outlined. Please, if you want, print out the source sheets. Remember to talk about these things on Sukkot. All of these various lessons that the Sukkah teaches us about the reality of our lives, about the reality of our communities, about the reality of our relationship with Hashem. And then in the final analysis, it also teaches us of the balance between the Sukkah and the Arba Minim, and the importance of each of us finding our responsible place within society. We're going to be judged this year. I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to judge us on how we meet the challenges he is presenting us with. And all of us must do our part, communally, leaders of our country, the country itself, and all of us must do our part individually as well, as we re-enter this uncertain world and try to embrace that uncertainty and meet its challenges. And based on that, Be'ezras Hashem, if we do our part, please God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bless us with a healthier and a better year this coming year.